Welcome to Ever Beyond.
Broadcast through the Wolf Spirit Media Network.
Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond.
Please join us in the chat room at www.wolfspiritradio.com/listen. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
You are listening to Wolf Spirit Radio, and you are listening to Ever Beyond on Ever Beyond Radio as well, all at the same time, simulcasting due to the clever magic of Soundcraft. And yes, indeed, welcome to show number 3 of 4 live shows from Wolf Spirit Radio on the Sunday Alternative Service here on wolfspiritradio.com. I'm also going to be building some extra websites soon, that all to come. Just kind of bringing all the ideas together, and bringing some more people together. So if you wish to join us, I'm looking for producers, I'm looking for graphic artists, web people, people who understand, you know, I don't do Instagram, but you know, it's big. So anybody who'd like to kind of do the Instagram bit or the Facebook bit, well, so we've got Facebook people, Twitter, these things. Social medias. I'm not very sociable, so that's like not very good medium. So anyway, here we are. This is Ever Beyond Radio, and tonight my guest is an old friend of mine. I've known him longer than I've been doing radio, actually. We've had many lovely discussions over the years. Thomas with his very academic, learned, erudite and all those. Yeah, you're in for a treat. If you like a bardic tone to things, we're going to have a lovely evening. Thomas Dufferne, welcome to you. How are you?
Yes, hello. I'm fine. Thanks, Jeremy. Thanks for inviting me on.
Right. Okay. So let's just get, are you holding your mic?
I am. Yeah. I've got it in front of me. Yeah.
Just keep it pointed towards you. Cause if you look away from the mic, you'll lose your sound as well.
Okay.
So, stay on mic and we'll be good. So you're speaking from, you're not coming from Britain, are you?
No, I'm speaking from the middle of France, the heart of France, near Limoges, in a place that's the geographical center of France, actually. It's equidistant from here to Paris as it is to the south coast, Nice and all that.
Oh, fabulous.
And to the Atlantic and to Switzerland. So it's a beautiful location, and I'm here setting up the European Peace Museum. So I'm here for strategic reasons. I think Europe is going through some problems, and I'm doing my bit to help, you know, Europe as a whole find a voice of peace in the world.
Right. So, can you back off a little bit from the mic? We're getting a little bit of breath on that.
Sorry.
That's okay. we are being broadcast tonight, sponsored by Sellotape and String Incorporated, holding the world together with duct tape. The center of France, a very, in the news kind of place at the moment. What's the story? I mean, a lot of people are interested in the politics of things. I know, you know, in our conversation, we don't go there because we're talking on a different kind of plane to the political thing, but it's a real thing and there is stuff going on in your country as we speak, and it would be great to have it firsthand, local, so to speak, rather than getting it through the mainstream news. What's going on for the people that you know, that you speak to?
Okay, well, what you should realize is I've only just moved here from Scotland. I've been living in Scotland for 7 years, and before that I lived in Wales for 10 years, London for 10 years, and I was born and brought up in Canada. So I see things from quite an internationalist perspective. Here in France, I've hit it just at the time of the elections for president. It was very interesting listening to the debates, and something that the French have that we in Britain don't have is a two-tier election system, which basically weeds out extremist candidates. I think it's a brilliant idea, and it was invented by de Gaulle, so that in the first round of voting, if we had this for Prime Minister, we would have a much more sensible kind of political system in the UK. So in the first round of voting, anybody can stand pretty much. You get extreme right, extreme left, all kinds of people. But in the second round, only the top two go through, which allows people to rethink their vote and then to cast it either for, you know, a progressive candidate or some kind of conservative. In this one, it was interesting because it was Emmanuel Macron, who was a former socialist friend of Hollande, current president, but he decided to do his own thing, and he worked outside the Socialist Party, which is riven with infighting and so on, a bit like the Labour Party. So it was Macron, who's a visionary, I think, and if you read his prospectus, he's a bit like Trudeau, Justin Trudeau. He wants to get France working again. That was his slogan. And people have likened him to Napoleon. He's a kind of charismatic, young, and highly intelligent leader. He was made by his wife, who he met as a schoolboy. She was his drama teacher. And even to the, and they had a, you know, love affair which has lasted all their lives. It's a sweet love story. And even today, she coaches him on all his public speaking and things. So this, you know, he appealed, I think, to the moderates, to the center, to the left, because he does retain some socialist ideas, you know. On the opposite side, we had Marine Le Pen, who was appealing to, I suppose you could call it the French nationalist or populist vote, and was arguing for, you know, France for the French. It was a bit like UKIP, I suppose, the kind of UKIP message, England for the English type of message. And fortunately, in my opinion, the people of France rejected that populist message. And, you know, French nationalism, which is, I don't think is the way to go. However, there's some interesting, you know, supporting Le Pen are all kinds of anti-globalist factions. And in my local village, there's two posters, one side by side, Macron and Le Pen. Somebody scribbled on Macron, you know, the face of the beast, Apocalypse Now, you know, Illuminati candidate. So these kind of anti-globalization mantras that you find in conspiracy theory circles, yeah, they surface. And, you know, so some people would support the nationalist position, you know, from that perspective. It's not what I share, but, you know, it's interesting stuff. So there we are. That's my take on the recent elections.
Interesting. Okay. Now, there's a lot of wind that's coming in through your mic. I'm having to do lots of fiddling. Sorry to moan about your audio, all the time there, Thomas, but, once we get it sorted, cause, you know, we really want to hear you and your mic is not doing your voice justice. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
So you need to have it, you have to have it beside you, pointing towards your mouth, but not kind of in front of you so that the air bypasses the, I'm going to talk slightly off the axis of the mic.
Right. I'll keep playing around.
That's kind of good. That's kind of good. Pull it a little bit back from your, towards your cheek. Yeah. They're very sensitive, these mics, but,
God, yes.
They also get the air as well. Okay. So now, I mean, we've done, so many things. Thanks for talking a little bit about the France, situation. Yeah. And obviously, you know, as you say, you've only just arrived there, but you know, that, you know, you're touching the pulse, you know, you're getting the pulse. So,
I also think Britain should adopt that two-tier candidate, electoral system, but I'm trying to figure out how that could be done. I'm also a political scientist among everything else, so I'm interested in governance systems, democracy, and you know, all these kind of governance issues. And I'm concerned about the future of the UK as well, so we maybe get on to that later in our discussion.
Yes, but there's, you know, there's, of course, you know, there's the greater aspect. Now, a few years ago, we connected with this fellow. I don't know if you want to talk about Jerry. We connected with a fellow called Jerry Cannon, through two completely different connections. But, I was speaking with Jerry and he said, yeah. And you know, Thomas the Fern, don't you? Like almost the first thing he said to me. You know Thomas the Fern. I said, like, how do you know that? You know, the connection was completely through the internet radio. And he okay. could, just the first thing he said to me when we had a conversation, you know Thomas the Fern. And it was like, I do, actually. How do you know that? You know, and he never told, well, I don't know how he knew that you knew me. Unless you'd already said, oh, I know somebody who does internet radio.
I can't remember. I can't remember how I first came across Jerry, but as you know, he reckons he's found the Ark of the Covenant buried in a hill in North Africa, I think in Egypt, in the desert. And we had some interesting communications about that a few years ago. I don't know. And I then saw him. I visited Spain and I saw him. He lives in the south of Spain. We had long chats, but I think we would have heard if he'd have got the permission to do the archaeological dig. What was holding him up was permission slips from the government. And then, of course, there was the tremendous instability in Egypt with the revolution and, you know, Tahrir Square and absolute chaos. So far as I know, he hasn't yet done the dig. I'd love to see him do the dig. And one thing that interests me actually is the links between Moses and ancient Hebrew traditions, particularly the Kabbalah, esoteric traditions, and ancient Egyptian traditions. I'm primarily a scholar of religious history and philosophy of religion, and I can see lots of influences from ancient Egyptian metaphysics and so on onto Hebrew thought. Freud himself believed that was true. He wrote a book called Moses and Monotheism, in which he argues that Moses was an initiate in Akhenaten's tradition, who after the rejection of Akhenaten's monotheism, took to the desert with some followers because he was so annoyed at monotheism going down like that. That was Freud's view. And other people have, you know, looked at the chronology. And I mean, it's possible. I think there was definitely an influence on Jewish Hebrew thought.
Somebody has messed around with the timing. If you can reconcile the timing, then everything drops back into place and it becomes apparent that Moses was Tutmosis. And yeah, he was an initiate. He knew all the stuff and he nicked a bit of the control panel. You know, it's like, sure. You know, he nicked the engine out of the truck. Basically.
That's one way of putting it. Yeah. Which is a bit naughty, really, if you think about it.
Rather, unless it was given to him and they said, take this away.
And look after it, yeah. And then there's the intriguing thought of Skota, the daughter of Pharaoh, who's mentioned in one of the ancient Druid texts from Ireland by Geoffrey Keating, who was the Herodotus of Irish history, as being Pharaoh's daughter coming and founding Ireland and Scotland. Bringing that wisdom, and a friend of mine's written a book about that, who lives up near Inverness.
All right, up my way. But the other thing is that there are other theories that say that it all started in Atlantis, and then they landed in Ireland, and then later came to Egypt, which is why there's a similarity, but it's instead of the out of Africa, there's the out of Ireland, theories. And I'm really fascinated by those because I had a strong pull to go to Ireland and, I did and had a magical time.
Right.
It took me back to kind of really deep soul memories of, a very, very long time ago, long, you know, prehistory kind of things.
Sure. Well, I'm quarter Irish, and I've been to Ireland many times, and I went to a pagan camp on the west coast of Ireland some years ago, meeting various druids and stuff, and I was shown a mountain where they said, you know, that's where the Tuatha De Danann landed, the gods, traditionally from Ireland. They came from the sky, so they were intelligences, angelic intelligences that then came to land in Ireland. So,
yes,
there's also that theory.
In the book, in the parlance of the audience that we have here, they were Lyrans, or Lyrans.
Right. Okay.
Escaping from the first round of, or one of the rounds of the Galactic Wars.
Okay, that's one theory. I'm going to suspend judgment.
Yeah,
on that,
but they say because they're, you know, the Lyrans are higher dimensional beings, higher right. dimensional, so they would appear to be kind of pixie and angelic, non-terrestrial human like. But apparently, you know, our ancestors that, you know, we were made by breeding them with the reptilians. But that's a long story. That's a very long story. And it's a very interesting story. But,
right. Well, we might get onto that a bit later.
Yeah.
Can I just say a bit more about myself? Can I come
Please talk about yourself as much as you'd like
to. I just want to introduce myself to the audience because, you know, I'm not primarily a ufologist researcher, and I'm not I'm not going to be speaking primarily from that perspective, but I do want to bring that in later. Just to explain a bit about my background, I'm a historian, okay, and I did my degree at the University of London, and I love history. And as I mentioned, the Herodotus of Ireland, he's a chap called Geoffrey Keating, who was killed by one of Cromwell's soldiers, because he was a Catholic priest, in fact. And he wrote a sacred history of Ireland that goes right back from the beginning of the world and the ancient Druid generations and so on, right down to his day. He was a fascinating chap. I was inspired by Herodotus, who was the founder of history, when I first read ancient history A-level in Brighton, where I grew up partly. And I walked around the streets of Brighton thinking, you know, why don't we get taught about ancient Greek and Latin history, Roman history, more? You know, why is classics just reserved?
Yeah, I always wonder that. By the way, we got a lot of Americans in our audience, and A-levels are, what do you call them in America? Higher grades.
Senior grade.
Senior grades. Yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah, when you're 18.
Yeah, to get into university, you have to pass these qualifications, yeah. So I read ancient history, which was quite unusual, which got me to know Herodotus's work. And to me, the historian is like a forensic scientist who examines the debris of history. He was looking at the Greek and Persian wars. He wanted to know why the Persians attacked Greece. And he went around the Middle East asking everybody he could meet who might have some data to shed on that. He went to the temples of Phoenicia and Egypt. He went to Babylon, it's thought. He traveled all over Greece. And he was asking people who'd taken part in the war, you know, what was your story? And it's amazing to think that was the first time that history as an independent intellectual pursuit really came into being. Before that, you'd had your temple priests who would give the narrative of how it was. So you'd have the chronology of whatever religion was being promoted in that particular city or region. But the idea of free inquiry, history means inquiry, the free inquiry of an independent mind, independently looking at information, was new. So that was the beginning of history, which I decided very early on that was the most interesting academic subject to pursue. But I also discovered philosophy, and I'm also a philosopher, because history alone isn't enough. I then went off and did degrees in history at London and studied philosophy at Bristol University. Because you have to analyze the data of history. And for that, you need philosophy, you need logic, you need metaphysics. You have to ask, what does history mean? Where does it come from? And during the 80s, I was working at in London. That's when I did my degree. And I worked on world history and European history. And I was fascinated by the history of ideas, history of philosophy. And I worked very hard also. I'd launched an organization called Philosophers and Historians for Peace. So I was born in that generation that grew up under the shadow of the Cold War with the threat of nuclear annihilation on this planet. And I felt that I should do my best as an intellectual to prevent World War III happening. In the 80s, I'd worked in Canada. I lived in Alberta for some years, 4 years. And I worked in a veterans hospital in Calgary, nursing World War I soldiers, World War II Canadian soldiers, veterans. And they told me the horrors of what they'd lived through. I met people still scarred by the Battle of the Somme. And they told me, Thomas, you know, you're a bit wasted here. Go back to Europe and try and prevent World War III. So that's why I came back to London in 1981 and worked at the University of London. And then I set up basically, I was asked to investigate the feasibility of creating an Institute of Peace Studies in the University of London system. It's a federal university that has many colleges, many of which are well known, like University College, the London School of Economics, King's, Imperial College, each of which is as big as most universities, right? SOAS is another. And my job was to go around and ask them all, would they like to collaborate on creating a intellectual think tank that would look at peace and conflict prevention? So I did that work from 1989 to 1983, effectively, just at the time when the Gulf War was breaking out, if you recall. And the world went into an absolute paroxysm of violence in the Middle East with the invasion of Iraq under the elder Bush president. And I launched an International Institute of Peace Studies and Global Philosophy, actually, in 1991, the same year that invasion and conflict took place. And my emphasis has always been on preventing wars. Other people look at strategy and victory. There's a huge number of institutions, war studies centers. You can train in naval colleges, you know. The Institute of Strategic Studies in London is world famous for military types to look at how they can win wars. I had a long discussion with Professor Lawrence Friedman, who's Professor of War Studies at London, saying, you know, we're not doing totally different things. I'm trying to prevent the wars happening. You're trying to, like, work if a war breaks out, then obviously we want to win it. But I'm actually one step further back. I'm trying to prevent the wars. Because I think in a world of mass weapons, mass destruction, nuclear weapons and so on, if World War III happened, you know, it's unwinnable. We all lose. Russia loses. China loses. The USA loses. Europe loses. And Britain loses. So I think we should be emphasizing preventing these wars. So that's where I'm coming from, basically. And then I did a PhD in all this at the University of London. Whilst I was researching, setting up the institute and running it as a academic, I was also, you know, writing the theory behind the search for peace from 1945 to 2001. And I deliberately stopped the time clock at September 11th in 2001 with the attack on New York. My thesis goes up to that point. And I looked at every kind of thinker and intellectual, philosopher, psychologist, historian, who'd been researching how we can prevent war. A lot of these people worked with UNESCO. I've also worked with UNESCO. And they were looking, they were anthropologists, economists, psychologists. You know, it's a multidisciplinary thing. In World War II, the Manhattan Project gathered the greatest minds of the Western world to make a giant bomb, you know. What I was saying is we need an equivalent gathering of intellectuals now, like a new Manhattan Project, but this time to crack the secret of peace. That is the remaining mystery. If we can spend billions on CERN cracking particles that fly around, you know, in the Higgs boson field, which is all very exciting, I think, you know, we should also spend a bit of money cracking the secret of peace between religions, between cultures, between nations and linguistic systems. So that's what I did in my own way as a doctoral thesis. And, you know, I've been quite busy since doing that, really. And now you're introducing a whole new dimension. You're saying, well, Thomas, you've got to look at also intergalactic wars. So, you know, I can take that on board.
Because, you know, everything has its context. You have the context of, all right, so one of the problems with war is that it's very, very connected with money. In fact, according to historian, do you know Catherine Austin Fitz?
I don't think so.
She's an economic commentator. Very interesting to listen to. But she's basically saying that the model of central banking actually relies on war to keep going. That's it. That's its fuel. And its fuel is essentially human suffering.
Well, then there's something wrong with the banking system if that's true. It has to be changed.
Yes. Well, there is. Yeah. I mean, we can all agree that there is something, more than something, very wrong. There's something very, very wrong about it. And that we can actually get by without a banking system. We can get by without a government even. And we'd still have roads, or we wouldn't need roads because we wouldn't have the corporate. See, that this is the next layer that we have an issue. Is there something wrong with the corporate establishment as well? It's all the same thing. And there's a lot of fraud in it. You know, it's an illusion. It's a make believe. If we can exist and thrive in a make-believe world, what happens if we actually create a real world for people? You know, where people's votes really do count. And because you vote for somebody that you know, you vote in a local way and a networked way and a global way and a galactic way. Why not have all of the systems of the galaxy available to us as well? Because, and one of the problems is that we are infected with this thing that they, you know, that we call war. And my personal, research on this is that it's all due to a very, very ancient PTSD, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder. And we all know that the effect of PTSD is to cause people to behave very, very strangely indeed. And to the point of wanting to destroy one's own self, which, you know, you'd think that we had an urge to survive. But with PTSD, we have an urge to destroy ourselves.
Well, I think you're right. One of the chapters of my thesis involved psychological research into conflict and violence. And I think there is a streak in human beings that self-harm. Now, why we can discuss that psychologically, but I think war is a form of self-harm. We're doing it to ourselves as a species.
Yes, exactly.
We're one of the very few species, I mean, the only species that organizes in such a profoundly intricate way to self-destruct. And it's a paradox that we're very good at organizing for violence. We're much less good at organizing for peace. Let me just carry on a little bit because it's relevant to the wider discussion. So in the thesis, what I argued is that we won't be able to make sense of the search for peace on this planet until we look at history in a new way. You see, in the 19th century, historians looked at history in a materialist way. The avant-garde historians of Cambridge and London and so on in the early 19th century and right up to the middle of the 19th century were basically arguing like Karl Marx that history is the material history of production and social exchange and the exchange of capital. You see, Marx is a very clever historian in his own right, who looked at the history of working people and so on. But what's interesting, I've been reading an intellectual biography of Marx recently, and in the late 19th century, there were people organizing peace internationals as well. He was organizing the International, which was run from London, to bring working people together and solve the problem of capital, which you raised, because his analysis was, we won't get peace until we solve the problem of capital. And we get the locked energy that is held by the banking system redistributed to the people, because it's actually their selves, their frozen energy in the Hegelian sense, that has been locked up in this, in these vaults in the form of gold. So get it back to the people, which he, I think he misinterpreted. He made a fatal mistake here. He thought if you have either a political or a military revolution and seize the banks, somehow everything's going to be right, you know. But actually, we know what happened in Russia and China. It didn't work out because you just got military communism. And what I discovered is that Marx himself was actually quite a militaristic fellow. He refused to ally with the International Peace Network that was set up at the same time as the International. He said, no, we don't want to work with all those peace people. They're all utopians. And he was a great lover of military history, especially so was his colleague Engels. And they actually wanted Germany to launch a war on Russia. They thought Russia was a very backward nation and should be conquered and civilized. And tragically, you know, when Russia was invaded, attacked in World War I, and then finally in World War II, in a sense, it was Marx's ideas without people realizing. So anyway, all that comes from, I think, a false reading of history. History is not just a materialist, evolution of class struggle, in my opinion. It's ultimately a spiritual unfolding. I'm with a different, you know, understanding of history, that it represents a spiritual unfolding. And that I've worked with the ideas of Carl Jung, the great transpersonal psychologist, who says that, human beings are part of a collective psyche. We share a collective unconscious. And ideas and archetypes influence us. He also wrote about early UFO phenomena as some kind of visitation from the collective unconscious. And I think different epochs in history resonate with different archetypes. And that to study that whole field, I've coined the phrase transpersonal history. So it's looking at, so let's take, you know, Osama bin Laden became the devil figure for many Americans. So did Saddam Hussein. Hitler had earlier in the 20th century. You know, everybody wants a good devil to fight because then you can justify torture, the bombing of Dresden, whatever. You know, if the other guy's the devil, you can do whatever atrocities you want. Likewise, the Muslim factions demonize America. So Khomeini, after his revolution in Iran, he started calling America the great Satan, and Britain was the little Satan. And if you demonize the other guy as the devil, you can, justify any violence. What I'm saying as a philosopher of history and religion is we have to step back from the brink of this demonization. You know, there's a bit of a devil and a bit of an angel in all of us. We're multidimensional creatures. We have psyches that are complex. We have conflicts with people because they push the wrong buttons and so on and so on. We need to, find a way of declaring peace at the level of the collective unconscious. And that means coming to terms with the other guy's devils. And I'm slightly worried about the Draco's versus Lyran's kind of theory of history, because it seems to me it's Zoroastrianism kind of writ large, put up into a cosmological battle. And it's absolute good against absolute evil. So, I want to say we need to understand. Maybe these are actually within us. These archetypes.
Well, look. Let's first of all have a look at, you know, like you said, absolute good versus absolute. You know, the Dracos are very easy to demonize. You know, they have utter disregard for any other race. they don't do themselves any favors in terms of PR. Decided to use, what we called people as food. And if we were chickens, it would be the same thing. You know, all those humans, they're terrible. They're evil. They round us up into farms and, you know, they eat us by the dozen.
So have you ever met a Draco or seen one empirically in this lifetime?
Personally, I am unable to say yes or no.
You might have met one, but they were pretending to be a human being.
That's possible. I mean, there are people whose energy is really intense and that doesn't feel human. But that's just a matter of, personal perception, isn't it? You know, how sure. I feel about somebody, I might be triggered. You know, I might be, seeing something else, feeling something from my own memories. You know, it's very difficult to say, yes, this, you know, absolute proof. Okay. But here's the thing, you know, it's easy to doubt something that somebody told you, but something that you felt yourself and you feel on a regular basis, you know, that makes you an expert in that, doesn't it?
Well, it makes you an expert in your own feelings.
Yes. Well, here's the thing. If I was a fisherman, Thomas, and I was in this particular pond every day, I would eventually get to know the different levels of pull that the different sizes of fish would be, tugging on my line. You know, I'd get to know the feel of it. That's what I'm saying. You know, your own personal experience in feeling and experiencing the world. That's what I'm talking about. That is the only truth we can really talk about.
Well, that's part of transpersonal history, isn't it? I mean, the psyche is a complex thing, and you're using the metaphor of a lake as a good one. We're all like this lake. And we all have our own currents and sensitivities. And some people develop what we call psychic skills. They develop what are called siddhis in Buddhist and Hindu terminology. And the Druids literature also has that. So clairvoyance, telepathy, these kind of altered states of consciousness are studied by transpersonal history, right? And transpersonal psychology. And, they're interesting. They've been left out of the normal narrative of history, which is event A happens, event B happens, event C happens. If we live in a quantum universe of interconnected subjectivities, then if I will a certain event to happen, it's more likely to happen. So will comes in, just as it does in the quantum experiments, you know, the observer effect. So if I'm having good will, and I'm living a life of prayer, meditation, and spiritual focus, it's more likely that good things are going to be happening around me and happiness is going to be breaking out. These are the kinds of experiments people are doing. You've probably seen that movie, What the Bleep Do We Know, yeah?
Oh, that yes. Documentary. Oh, yes, indeed.
Okay, so that we're talking about those kind of effects. Now, if you put those back retrospectively into history and you analyze historically, I mean, history is not just a history of wars and battles. It's also a history of great saints and sages, and mystics and, you know, people like Ibn Arabi, experiencing telepathy with his teachers in Spain, or the great Kabbalists of Safat, who were experiencing altered states of consciousness, very profound. And the Christian mystics of medieval France, you know, they were all over the place. The Gnostics, the Cathars, who were in this part of France, Limousin. Aquitaine. So I'm interested in the esoteric currents behind Orthodox history, because I think there's been a suppression.
I'd certainly agree.
Of the really the good news of history.
Absolutely.
Actually. So people are actually nicer and more loving than we realize when you actually get to their transpersonal selves.
That's what this is what the news is trying to tell us. The news, the mainstream media, controlled media. Are trying to make it so that when you walk out into your street, you feel scared for your life.
And there are terrorists out to get you.
Everywhere, and they're just all going to, you know, if it's not terrorists, it's going to be the police. You know, your local police, you can't trust them anymore.
Well, that justifies the security state that's been erected.
Exactly.
And the surveillance state. And it's a big business, going back to money again. It's a racket. Whereas the good news of spiritual enlightenment and, you know, the work of the saints of history is that you can cut through all that. If you actually, and I'm working on a series of commentaries on the Gospels, on the Jewish writings, Ketuvim, and on the Quran. I'm halfway through them all. And if you reinterpret these amazing core scriptures from a good news perspective, a transpersonal perspective, you know, they are laying a blueprint for human liberation and freedom. You know, the saint can walk out of the jail. The guards fall asleep. You know, you can go into the fire and not be burned. And I think that's what we need to be cultivating on this planet at this moment. We need transpersonal wisdom to get us through what is quite a tough time. So let me just share one other thing that I said.
Well, I just want to, you know, come in with that.
You want to comment on that?
Yeah, right? Because the idea that there are, okay, so we're all on a path of what they call ascension. And some people started a while ago, and some people just started, and some people haven't quite started yet, but we're all going up an exponential scale, an exponential curve that is getting steeper. That old hockey stick, you know, the old hockey stick that they said global warming was about. No, that's global consciousness. And okay. And people, one of the things that everybody is always worried about, oh, when will Fred down the road wake up? You know, I don't think the world is going to wake up in time for the big event, whatever the event is going to be.
Right.
But my theory is like, we're all going to get there. It's all right. We're all going to get there. Everything's fine. Just ignore the news and look at your, yeah, you know, your own little world. How is your toilet flushing? How does your fridge close? If your fridge doesn't close properly, get it fixed. You know,
sure.
And
attention to micro detail helps big picture.
Keep yourself grounded.
Yeah.
The other thing is to not get involved in the emotion of the false emotions, because false news, fake news, is designed to create fake emotions. Fake emotions of, like, you know,
sure,
you're going
to keep you, yeah, plugged into fear and terror and, you know, the whole cycle of that.
Absolutely, yeah, because with fear, you know, if you were to eliminate fear and hatred, well, there wouldn't be anything, you know, but the fear and hatred comes from the PTSD. So if we, all the way back, it starts off with a shock that humans can't take the shock. And so,
well, that's your particular historical,
yeah,
theory.
that's my theory, and that we have sorry, Thomas, but that we have an unhealed grief that hasn't, you know, when some people don't react very well with grief, and they get violent, or they, yeah, drink, or they don't get into the grief of it, and they haven't grieved for the things, and we've forgotten what we had to grieve for. That's the thing.
Well, tell me, I'm sure the listeners have heard this before, but tell me for my benefit your theory of what is the great shock event that we're all grieving for.
Well, as I said, you know, the great shock event is that you meet these new people, and suddenly they decide that, you know, they're not listening to you and they're going to eat you, and they invade your planets and they explode them, and there's all these things, and
These are the Dracos
invading Lyra. And what happens is that
the home planet of Lyra was where? In the Lyran constellation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Earth was not a home planet, it was later settled by Lyrans.
Yes. This is many, many thousands of millions of years ago.
Well, you must give me the time charts. I'm a historian, I want to see the dates here.
It's like, well, you know, imagine, here's the thing. Okay, so
the Lyrans hid out here, and then the Dracos came after them.
It's a cat and mouse. Well, here's the thing. The Dracos used to own this sector, this solar system. And it was a key solar system, because it's like a kind of motorway interchange. It's
right,
probably like where you are right now, you know, because all the roads pass through the middle, don't they?
More or less. They don't come through my village, but they're all within half an hour drive.
Yeah. So the thing about Earth is that it was in a solar system that had a kind of interdimensional, it's called a hyperspace portal, right? It allows people to transfer between different star systems, and it's like a highway. And
okay,
there was very much like, Deep Space Nine, Star Trek's Deep Space Nine. There was a space station near the portal. And, you know, it was controlled by the reptilians, right? Deep Space Nine is the story of Tiamat, right? Okay, so Tiamat was the big planet, that was, where the base was, where they controlled Death Stars, like in Star Wars. All these different science fiction films have got a little piece of the whole big picture. So these...
Well, it might... Yeah. I mean, yeah.
So let me just...
I'm going to suspend judgment on all this. I mean, it might be the other way around, that this narrative which you've created and which your colleagues have created, you know, is it's part of the collective zeitgeist of our times, right? This is a story that makes sense. It may not be objectively true. Mm. We can discuss what we mean by truth.
Yeah. Well, so the thing is...
But send me the timelines and chronologies.
So here's the thing. First of all, if you're talking about years, a year is only something relative to our planet.
Well, our solar system, yeah.
No, our planet. If we were on Mars, a year would be 24 months on our measurement scale.
Sure.
All right, so when you're talking about years, we're just talking about how many times the Earth has gone around the sun. If you're talking about a different star, but let's simplify it. About a billion years ago. Not that it really makes a lot of difference, because there's eternal time frames.
Where in your cosmology comes the limitation of Big Bang theory? Because most Big Bang cosmologists say the universe itself only burst into being, say, 13 billion years ago. I don't personally like Big Bang theory. I prefer a steady state universe myself.
I'm a things burst out from all sorts of points at different times kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like multiple Big Bangs that aren't really Big Bangs, they're more like like an engine starting.
Can I just say something? If you or any of your listeners or anyone out there is in touch with any genuine extraterrestrial intelligences, like good ones, like Lyrans or whatever you want to call them, genuine ones, I would love to organize the first interplanetary intergalactic philosophy seminar. They must have philosophers among these people.
Oh, we certainly do. And
let's get talking to each other about advanced, you know, the metaphysics of goodness.
So all right,
transform this planet,
Thomas,
to, you know, a Shambhala world, which is what it's supposed to be. Right?
Absolutely. You want to talk also to Alfred Lumbermont Weber. Have you heard of this man's name?
I have indeed listened to some of his talks on YouTube, and he's a fellow Canadian like me.
Yes.
Interesting chap, and I like his theory, although it's disturbing, of plasma and artificial intelligence. You know, it has a malevolent quality, which he reckons actually helped manifest 9/11, which is a topic I'm hoping we're going to get onto in this conversation.
Oh, yeah. Well, I got lots of bits of 9/11 as well. I was explaining to a friend of mine, you know, a couple of days ago about the secret technologies that I'm aware of. So we'll talk about that, and we'll put more puzzle pieces together. Because this is what it's all about for everybody. You know, I keep saying everybody's got a piece of the puzzle, and everybody has a piece of each other's puzzle. You know, I'm sure that there are questions that you may have unanswered that I'll just say blah, 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 blah. And you'll go, oh man, he just answered that question that I've had for 30 years. You know,
It's like the famous line by Bob Dylan. I'll let you be in my dream if I can be in yours.
Exactly. So.
He said it as a poet who won the Nobel Prize for Poetry. I think well deserved myself.
So, yes, old Bobby. Old. So,
Let me add something. Because I want to just explain this to your listeners and to you. As part of the doctoral thesis, what I did in practical terms was I created a mediation service, which is the first mediation service that I know in operation. That deals with religious disputes. It's called the Multi-Faith and Multicultural Mediation Service. I trained in California and San Francisco as a mediator. I worked locally in Islington and Southwark in London. And these kind of disputes involve neighbors falling out over garden fences or too much noise from parties, that kind of thing. I then worked in schools as a mediator for kids who have lots of bullying problems and conflicts, and a lot of emotional, you know, rivalry and conflict. And then I had this brainwave, why don't we get the religious leaders of the planet, you know, mediating conflicts that have religious dimensions to them. And this was when the Balkan Wars were starting, and then the Middle Eastern conflicts like Israel, Palestine and so on. And also in Ireland, the Catholic versus Protestant squabbles, and in Kashmir where you've got Muslims and Hindus fighting. So as a philosopher of religions, I set up this multi-faith mediation service, which is still running. I've dealt with lots of interfaith case dispute resolution cases. And as a spin-off from that, I then in, I think it was 2008, I went to Israel and Palestine and interviewed lots of activists, peace activists, thinkers, people in refugee camps on the Palestinian side, people on the Israeli side who were suffering from bombing attacks and so on, trying to see it from both perspectives. And I set up a thing called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission for the Middle East, TRCME, which is, you know, there isn't another one like it. It's completely ridiculous if the governments of the world were serious. I mean, Tony Blair was for a decade supposed to be in charge of peacemaking between Israel and Palestine. And so far as I can see, he didn't do anything apart from tour a few Palestinian factories and get a few photo opportunities. He didn't do the work. I was completely unfunded, unacknowledged, and behind the scenes, trying to do that work. I wrote to him several times, you know. But so if we're going to solve the conflicts of the Middle East, we need to be sensitive to their religious dimension. Muslims, Jews, Christians, Baha'is, Zoroastrians, they're all part of the complex mix. And in even in the Islamic world, you have Shias, Sunnis, Ismailis, Sufis, you have Alawites in Syria. And I've been watching with horror as, you know, the conflicts remain unresolved. In Syria, I wrote to the British foreign minister in 2000, I think it was 2000, probably 12, 13. I called for a peace policy for Syria. I said if we brought the faith leaders of Syria together, we could head off this conflict that's starting. And you know what I was told by the head of the Syria desk in the Foreign Office? I was told it is not British government policy to actually bring peace to Syria, in as many words.
No, because it's the British government policy to sell lots of weapons to all sorts of people who want to kill each other.
Right.
You know, so, it's yeah. against the principles of the corporate death industry that the that this country is a major part of.
Yeah, but I think that needs challenging and opposing with every sinew of our strength and every nerve of our collective intelligence, because it, in the long run, it's self-defeating and will lead to the destruction of the planet and our own.
Oh yeah, because it's parasitic, you see.
Well, it's parasitic and it's just plain stupid.
Yeah. I mean, well, you remember you were talking about Alfred Weber. And he was talking about this thing we call the black goo or the PPAI, I can't remember what you call it, the artificial intelligence that is
putting right. there.
Anyway, that it's that darkness that comes over people that causes them to become self-destructive, that is a non-human thing. And it causes a kind of a sense of anti-humanism as well. You know what I'm saying? It's like people who destroy themselves don't like themselves. They don't like anybody else either.
Okay, so the antidote to that has to be love.
Absolutely. Well, look, here's my thought about it.
And artificial intelligence can't do love. That's something Weber says.
It can't do love and it can't do creativity. So if we're creatively loving, then it can't thrive. So here's the thing.
That is our weapon. Yeah.
Here's the thing, right, now, taking it to a slightly different frequency band, to me, it's the equivalent of the candida, fungus growth that infects more or less every human being.
Okay, but most of us tolerate it and it's fine.
Most of it is fine, but, when it's out of hand, when it's been fed too much sugar, it goes mad. And it starts demanding friends, more of itself, and it also starts demanding food, i.e. sugar. So it makes you want to eat more yeasty things, and it makes you want to eat more sugar, and it completely hijacks you, right?
Right.
I believe that the human being, as a collective, not even human, it's like sentience in itself has been infected with this fungus-like thing. Now, given that, you know, I use a thing called borax to deal with fungus. You know, you can spray it on the walls, you can take small amounts, and it will actually push back the fungus and cause it to retreat and to not grow. And it doesn't like alkaline. So what we need is a philosophical version of alkalinity. Okay, there's your project, right. Dr. Thomas.
Okay, now I can answer that straight away because I wanted to talk about this. If you, happiness. To me, it's, well, you could say happiness, but before we even get there, which is the long-term goal, as Aristotle pointed out, I think we have to have truth. I think the real thing that cuts through the fungus and the black goo is actually truth. And when I talk about a truth and reconciliation commission for the Middle East, you know, the key word is truth. And I want to share another project that is relevant to this, because wars are created by politicians who are in the pay of big industrial complexes that run the military-industrial complex, and also the espionage chiefs that engineer propaganda, black propaganda, that makes excuses for wars. Okay. Now, if we're going to get politicians actually thinking through peace policies, which is what I'm asking them to do, we have to get them telling the truth to us as the people. Democracy doesn't work if politicians lie. It just simply doesn't work. And most wars and conflicts begin with lies. And it ends up with both parties a lie, you know. And then there's lies going on within a cabal, within a government structure. Like when we launched the Iraq War in 2003, Tony Blair was lying to Parliament. Some of his cabinet members were not being told the truth. You know, he was answerable to other cabals that still haven't come out. The Chilcot Commission of Inquiry never discovered who actually was pulling the strings behind the scenes. But what we know is it was all constructed on lies, right? And premised, by the way, on the big lie, which is 9/11, was done by Al-Qaeda and 19 terrorists. You know, we'll come back to that. But my argument, what I've done is I've drafted a bill which I've published on my blog and I've sent to key politicians in Britain and also France and America and the EU, calling for a truth and integrity bill in Parliament. So every politician and a member of the House of Lords or the Commons would have to sign an oath of truth-telling in all matters concerning official business. So if a constituency member goes to them and asks a question, or in writing, and says, you know, are you a member of this or that interest group? And they lie. Or, you know, they're in the floor of the House and they lie about something or whatever. They immediately lose office. Lying becomes a grounds for sacking the MP. And it would be a new by-election called. There'd have to be criteria, so it's you know, serious issues. Not frivolous and not personal stuff, like have you got a mistress who's got red hair or whatever, you know. It's serious stuff that affects the nation's well-being. Now, with that one bill, if we could get parliamentarians to pass that, if we got enough people of integrity, I think it would utterly and totally transform British and then other countries that adopted it, their politics. Because I think the big problem is layers of deceit, layers of lack of truth. The whole reason we don't know what happened at 9/11 is because the American political system is premised on lies. And it's been that way, you know, with cover-ups over Kennedy and the whole thing. In Britain, we've had the killing of David Kelly, who was a weapon inspector. Norman Baker, a Liberal MP, wrote a book about it. There are so many unanswered questions.
Oh, I mean, even back as far as Diana, you know.
Absolutely. That also, I think, has been covered up.
Oh, totally. All of these things.
Until we oblige our leaders to tell the truth to us by law. So there's a particular project I'm working on.
Well, I don't think even telling them by, you know, because they make promises not to tell each other. They make deep blood oaths not to speak anything. That's their problem. You're not going to get much truth out of somebody who's made a blood oath to never speak the truth.
Isn't making a blood oath to not speak the truth, isn't that a contradiction in terms of philosophically speaking? It's like the Cretan who says, I never lie, you know, you never know whether they're telling the truth or not.
Yeah, well, in this, that's true. You know, but in that world, everything is upside down.
Well, then we have to write it up again, you know.
Yeah.
I don't want to be so blanketly condemning of politicians. You should know I ran 30 meetings in the House of Lords in the 90s. As a freelance philosopher, I thought we ought to have discussions in Parliament on ethics and peace.
How many people turned up?
Quality, my dear friend, not quantity. Quite a lot.
Oh, good.
Quite a lot of interesting and influential people. And I think that Parliament has had, from time to time, people of great integrity. And in the times of Gladstone, for instance, in the Liberal governments of the 19th century, there was a realization that morality and ethics are actually part of political progress, and things like the Great Reform Act of 1832, which extended the franchise. You know, there is a tradition in political theory of enlarging the sphere of truth and diminishing the sphere of mendacity. Cicero is another example of an ethical politician who was up against Caesar. So I think I don't think all politicians are affected with the black goo. I'm not going to condemn them all. There are good people in there who are doing their best, and we should work with them and help them. So anyway, that's just one project. But the question of 9/11, can we get to that? Can I talk about
that? Oh, yeah. So, hang on. Did we do the tune? No, we haven't done the tune. Let's take a little break, because everybody has, you know, we're not those bladders don't hold as much as they used to. So let's have a quick bathroom break, and here's some John Lennon for you, because this is what we're all after. And welcome back to Ever Beyond. Welcome back to the studio. Yes. And tonight my guest is Thomas Dufern. And speaking from the central massif of France herself, seemingly the center of news at the moment. So now there's been a lot of news from that area. One of the things you mentioned before is the Cathars who inhabited that area. I've had lots of, I've had various, past life regression, things in the last few years, mainly because, a lot of the hosts on this shows, on my shows can do this and, you know, it's like, give me one. let's do a regression. And one of them did come back as a member of the Cathar community. It was quite an interesting thing.
What, of your personal past life?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So there's a lot of connection between, let's say, Sumeria, Babylon, Egypt, Rome, Greece, Germany, UK, you know, it's the same entity, you know, showing its way through. And one of its tricks is the money system. It doesn't look like it wants to let go of it.
Mm.
That's the thing,
right.
You know. We would like peace, but it does not.
That's interesting. That's a kind of narrative that I'm going to resist the temptation to comment on that. That's big picture history, which I love. You know, I'm schooled in the Toynbee School of British History and World History. I'm a world historian. But let me just leave your question hanging there at the moment, right? and it's a good introduction.
Swinging on its own rope.
To our second
bit. Please, go ahead.
I just want to start by commenting on the irony that you played the John Lennon song, which is a great song. And of course, he himself was shot, assassinated by probably a conspiracy involving the FBI, because he was calling for truth. And he was a musician using his celebrity status to protest against the Vietnam War, protest against the war on drugs and all kinds of, you know, the war on life.
There was also the JFK connection as well, according to one host is one of the reasons that Paul McCartney was murdered and replaced, is that he was investigating the murder of JFK. And got close to the truth. But that's another thing.
I'm saying thank you to John Lennon for his persistent determination to draw these questions to our attention.
Absolutely. He's a stream of consciousness.
That generation. Yes. Yeah, I'm of that generation that still wants the truth, right? So John, if you're listening out there, hello. Okay.
He's quite close actually. You know, we do hold the spirits of the Beatles very close in our hearts, and they come and visit us sometimes.
Good. Okay, so now I want to talk a bit about my work on 9/11. Because as a historian, I told you my doctoral thesis ended in 2001, and it was such a huge epochal event that was a trigger for the current outburst of conflicts in Afghanistan, Iraq, and now that have overspilled into Syria, other states in the Middle East. So I'm in the process of writing a book about the history of 9/11, using my forensic skills as a historian, using those questions that Herodotus would have asked if it had happened on his watch. And what I'm discovering, I'm actually amazed that no historians really, apart from one Swiss guy, Daniel Ganser, and very few others, have actually ever attempted to write the history of the events of 9/11 and its causes and its consequences. You know, what are historians doing? There's professors of history all over the world. I suppose it's down to me because I run Historians for Peace. But, you know, it shouldn't be. We should have seminars at the University of London and Oxford and Cambridge and, up with you at St. Andrews and Edinburgh. The greatest historians of our country and of Europe and so on should be working on this. There is, for instance, the Department of State in the US has an official state historian whose official job is to, you know, write the history of events in America. Absolute silence when it comes to 9/11. The Conference of American Historians, the body that gathers them all together, absolute silence when it comes to 9/11. We have in Britain, we have an historiographer royal. We have Regius professors of history at Oxford and Cambridge. Complete silence when it comes to 9/11. And yet, that was the trigger event that has embroiled Britain since 2003 in, you know, the invasion of Iraq, blowback from increased terrorism, which everyone warned would happen. And, exponential increase of military intelligence budgets, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think as a historian, I have a duty, a moral duty to try and look into it. That's what I'm trying to do, gathering sources. And my methodology is to suspend judgment. I'm not coming at this from, a particular pre-judgment that it was this or that cause. I'm just pointing to some of the obscurities and the strange anomalies with the official narrative. David Ray Griffin, for example, who's a theologian and philosopher, has gone into this with a fine tooth comb, and his book's a good place to start with. The official narrative, which was put forward in the 9/11 Commission report, was commissioned by Bush and packed with his toadies. And of course it produced a narrative that in the public mind through the media was constructed pretty soon after the event, that it was Al-Qaeda and it was Osama bin Laden, and that's it, end of story. Well, it's weird that the manifest from the planes didn't really include the hijackers. It was weird that some of the hijackers were still living. It was weird there was no plane debris from the Pentagon if it was a plane that went in there. It was weird that some people seemed to have had advanced warning it was coming and didn't go to work on 9/11. It was weird that there was huge amounts of insider stock trading to the point of billions of profits being made because people had insider information it was coming. It was tragic, it's a tragic event. I know New York. I love it. I was born in Montreal. I've, you know, been to New York many times. I love that city, and people don't realize it wasn't just the two great towers that came down. It was the Marriott Hotel, which was one of the biggest hotels in the US, with 800 guests in there, that was completely destroyed. And only one tiny section survived, with 19 people hiding in the rubble. You know, a world-class hotel was
19 again, huh?
Inside. Yeah. And Building 7 was destroyed again. So I've, you know, if you look at the research, it's obvious, really, that these buildings are brought down through some kind of internal demolition process. They were not brought down by planes or fires. It's just...
Well, yeah, I mean, and certainly Building 7.
It's logical. I think also the Twin Towers themselves. It's just, if you go to the scientists and engineers who've actually looked into this in detail, the evidence is sufficient to convince me that these were brought down by internal demolition. So the question then is, so what are we going to do about it? It was the worst crime ever to take place on American soil, and yet no one has actually been charged with the crimes, right? If I was an FBI officer, if I was the sheriff of New York, I would want, you know, to find out who did it. Now, the official narrative that was pumped out, I think, is lacking. It's got so many holes in, as I've just explained. So therefore, we're confronted with two possibilities. Either it was the buildings were wired by forces internal to the US government and the US intelligence agencies. That's one hypothesis. The argument there is that the US administration under Bush pre-planned this, because they wanted an excuse to extend America's hegemony in the Middle East. They wanted to support their ally Israel by knocking out an anti-Semitic and rather unpleasant regime under Saddam Hussein. And, you know, they thought somebody dreamed this up. This is a good plan. We'll do everything at once. We'll allow Al-Qaeda to attack the buildings. We'll even, like, wire them from within to help them. You know, the fact is that bin Laden had been working with the CIA in Afghanistan to bring down the USSR. And we funded him and trained him in all these dark arts. The British intelligence were helping as well. So it's also very odd that he was apparently in a hospital in Dubai a few months before 9/11 and visited by a CIA agent. So he seems to have been on quite good terms with Western intelligence right up to before the attacks took place. So I've never bought the idea that bin Laden personally hated the West so much he did 9/11. It's obvious he didn't particularly like the West. And he was critical of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians and so on. But, you know, certainly he could not have been responsible for wiring the buildings. He wouldn't have the team. So he had to have inside help. Also, I should point out, if you're not aware of it or other readers, have you heard of a woman called Susan Lindauer?
Oh, yeah. Since the Y2K thing, you remember Y2K and how...
I do, a bit of a long...
Our mutual muses, the two sisters, one of which that I married, a long time ago, we were the millennium bug couple, highly publicized on British TV. And that's when things started for me. That's when I started, clearing the scales from my eyes, when I saw what I was saying and what they were making me say were two very different things. And I thought, ooh, that's very disempowering. Maybe I'd better set up my own media network. Anyway,
okay.
2016.
So, so back to Susan Lindauer. She was an American agent working as an asset. So she wasn't a frontline intelligence agent, but she was being run by CIA people. But she was a peace activist like me, and her mission was to prevent wars, same as me, right? And so she was actually creating back-channel discussions with Iraq and with Libya and other countries that couldn't be acknowledged in public. There's all this stuff goes on behind the scenes. And she had loads of contacts. She went to Iraq a lot of times. And she knew that Iraq didn't have weapons of mass destruction. you know, the narrative on which the war in 2003 was launched was a false narrative. She knew that and could prove it. She also knew after 9/11 happened, if you recall, the media started saying, well, it's Iraq's fault, you know. And there was this ridiculous attempt at brainwashing the public imagination into thinking Saddam was responsible when he was actually opposed to Al-Qaeda, right? And Susan Lindau knew all this, and she tried to get messages from the Iraqi contacts she had, who were desperate to not only prove that they had no weapons of mass destruction, also to prove they had nothing to do with 9/11. And to welcome, they offered for the Americans to send an FBI team in to Iraq to help round up any rogue terrorists that they could find. You know, they had a common cause with America at rounding up these Islamist terrorists because, Iraq's secular, reasonably tolerant kind of, regime in terms of, allowing different branches of Islam to coexist and so on was being threatened and jeopardized by these Islamist terrorists, the Wahhabi-trained Salafists. So now what Susan Lindau knew is that all these attempts were rebuffed. The American establishment around Bush not only refused to actually open the channel properly, but what they did, which is incredible, is they then arrested her. And they stuck her in Carswell Air Base, a psychiatric ward, and they tried to literally, like, bury her. And they tried to silence all her, you know, whistleblowing. And they tried to use psychiatric drugs to, as she puts it, chemically lobotomize her. And she was kept in prison. Now, so to me, as a historian, that is prima facie evidence for some kind of cover-up going on. Powell, she indicates in her book Extreme Prejudice, which is an important historical document. I have spoken to her personally, but I'd like to interview her properly one day. You know, she reckons that Powell was involved in the cover-up, Bush himself, and it was a cabal who were trying to create, you know, to repaint 9/11 as an excuse to promote their imperialist hegemony.
Yes.
In the Middle East.
Yes, we call this in the alt media that we seem to be a part of, the deep state.
Yeah.
And okay. It's or the shadow government. We started to see it because suddenly on that day there was this place that seemed to be prepared for such a thing, where they whisked Dick Cheney, the vice president, yeah. Who is the real guy. He runs the solar system, you know. He's more or less, you know, he's like Darth Vader running the solar system. But anyway, do go ahead.
Okay, so she was incarcerated and shut up. Another question that I would like to ask was the knowledge that Tony Blair had about the depth of the conspiracy in the US, because if it was an internal US government cabal with intelligence agencies helping, surely we would have known that. The British state.
Somebody would have known about it because...
Surely otherwise our James Bonds aren't earning their money.
They're a complete waste. They're just covering up for the pedos. But look, Thomas, what it's all about is this, the covering up. Is the problem is that everybody was involved in it. The BBC was involved because they had a script that was read out inappropriately because building was sitting behind her. She reported the building is already falling, and there it was standing behind her, and she was reporting it as if it had happened. So it was badly timed. And the other thing, there's dozens of things about this that are so dodgy. So go ahead.
Say something about, you see, British intelligence should have known better. I'm a great believer in what I call the wisdom agencies. I'm an expert on John Dee, who was an intelligence stroke wisdom agent for Queen Elizabeth I. The British state has a very deep state. But what we've learned over the centuries is that if you are ethical, right, it's only if you are ethical that your empire survives. We had a, you know, the British Empire, which is a word coined by John Dee, lasted for 500 years. But it only did that because it earned the trust of people it worked with, through, you know, through truth telling. Now, what I feel very sad about Tony Blair and his cabal, Jack Straw and the rest of them, is if they were knowingly lying to the British people, to the BBC, the entire time, and already knew that the whole 9/11 thing was a false flag operation. Okay. As a historian, I can't write the true history of 9/11 and the consequences till I see the secret archives of MI6 and MI5. And, you know, there are official historians who write the history of British intelligence. But for this, I think, you know, somebody's got to come up and blow the whistle. One thing I'm very interested in is the fact that Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, in their WikiLeaks and other revelations, WikiLeaks has never revealed or never had downloads of anything to do with 9/11, which I find very odd. I think you would have thought someone would have come forward by now.
Here's another thing. Well, just one more thing, Thomas, is that we have a, one of our guests and hosts is a sound frequency analyzer. I don't know if you remember when I was talking about her when we were living in Glastonbury.
I think so, yeah, okay.
She's gotten quite sophisticated these days and through frequency can tell all sorts of things about all sorts of people and all sorts of frequencies tell all sorts of stories.
Okay.
And what she has determined by analyzing the voices of all of those involved, she came up with she agrees with you. She says that Colin Powell knew the most about 9/11.
Before it happened.
In terms of he had all the connections. And when he speaks, it's his experience that allows him to speak with his authority, but that he's also holding other things in his mind while he's speaking. So this is like scientific intuition now. Okay. We're getting to that point when you can hear frequencies that, and she can tell you when you're lying, and this is the brilliant thing. And you're going to love this, right? When you're speaking the truth, there are two notes that appear in your voice.
Okay.
One is the note of E and one is the note of B flat.
Okay, musical notes, so to
speak. When you take them to frequency and note and audible. It. Okay, so what are you going to love? All right, so those notes are the first notes of Purple Haze by Jimi Hendrix. Kidding, my brother. Kidding.
You're going to cut to the music now, are you?
So, actually, when you're hearing truth, you're actually hearing an audible dissonance. And when you're hearing an audible harmony, you're hearing not truth.
You're hearing lies, yeah. So are you saying that those notes are absent in the speech of people that are lying?
Yeah.
Is that what she's analyzed?
Yes.
Right. Now that's very interesting. It goes back to Pythagoras' theory about music is the fundamental coding of reality.
Absolutely.
Which is mathematical.
Absolutely. And it all comes, and it comes down to, Pythagoras has this frequency, for the note of A, which agrees with a lot of people who are, looking for, a kind of organic music note. And it's called 432. I'll just give you, this is the note of A as 432. Okay, the note on the thinnest string of the guitar, fifth fret. And that is, all right, if you square it, if you square 432, you get the speed of light.
This proves, ergo, God is a mathematician.
Yes. Yeah,
excellent.
If you halve 432. If you halve 432, you get 6³. Right, 216. If you halve it further,
they're ridiculous. Yeah.
If you halve it further, you get 108, which is the number of beads on a mala.
Correct. Yeah.
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 So yeah. This
the names of Shiva.
Yeah, so these are the octaves of A, which is the note of the harp.
I think Shiva did 9/11. Let's face it.
Let's face it. Well, look, because there are things.
He wants to apologize.
They use.
Can I just get back to my...
I also want to say that they use Shiva's weapon. They use Shiva's weapon on 9/11.
Well, you know, send me the link.
Okay, go ahead.
And that has to be done with forensic analysis of all the different factors. It's complicated to write this history. But one question I've got, by the way, and I'll just share it out there, is one reason for Tony Blair's silence might be that he earlier worked for British intelligence to infiltrate the Labour Party. I know people in the Labour movement who say, what on earth, who was Tony Blair? Where did he come from? David Shaler said, if you recall, he actually saw his file as an MI5 agent. Now, you know, if that's true, I think it's absolutely scandalous that British intelligence would infiltrate political parties and try and change them for its own agenda. It's possible because a historian at Cambridge recently discovered that British intelligence infiltrated Italian political movements and recruited a young guy called Mussolini when he was a bit of a free radical socialist and actually put him on the payroll of MI6. Mussolini's initial career when he built up the fascist movement was working as an agent for British intelligence. Now that shows you the ruthlessness of these intelligence agencies. I call them unintelligence agencies. If you're prepared to work, you know, with people like Mussolini to get your way politically, then I think you're lacking in ethics. And this is where I'm talking now as a kind of philosopher.
Well, this is the big secret, isn't it? That I believe the secret services are there to protect the secrecy of the fact that these people are evil and ruthless no matter what level you go to. And they,
that's not what they're supposed to be.
They're not supposed to be, but that's how it ends up.
Well, we have to fight them. We have to fight them with everything we've got, you know. But the only weapon we can use is truth. I'm a man of nonviolence. I'm the arch-druid of Britain's peace druids, among many other hats. I'm also a Christian and a Kabbalist and a mystic. And I know that you can't reach enlightenment on this plane of being unless you walk the path of truth, which is what Gandhi said, the Satyagrahi. So if people are using these dark arts to sustain power, then they will fall. You know, that was the point of the witness of...
That's what we're here for.
Yeah. Okay, so next I want to pose another question of 9/11, which is interesting, which is if it... I think we've established beyond doubt that it was assisted from within the destruction of that day by some kind of rogue American... you know, intelligence stroke government cabal. But did they have assistance from outside? There is another possibility, a hypothesis to explore, that some foreign power was also involved, not just USA. And there's a number of candidates that have been put forward. One is Saudi Arabia, which is an obvious choice. A lot of the so-called hijackers came from Saudi Arabia. There's the fact that the plane carrying lots of Saudi nationals was allowed to escape only a few days later with Bush's permission, with lots of family members of the Bin Laden family who'd been in America. You know, why the FBI didn't want to interview them all is just mind-boggling. There's also other evidence. Some Al-Qaeda suspects were arrested and had really high-up links to the Saudi Arabian establishment at a high level. And then those people that were revealed to be linked, i.e. who might well have known about 9/11, were found mysteriously dead soon after. So there are certainly fingers pointing at Saudi Arabian involvement. They would have also had the money to fund the whole thing. Now, if that's true, again, I think, you know, the American people, the British people, the world has the right to know, because Saudi Arabia is a very backward regime in terms of its human rights record and its mistreatment of women and you know, minority rights. I mean, religious freedom doesn't really exist in Saudi Arabia. You can't even teach philosophy in the schools and the universities. There's no kind of... The kind of intellectual freedom that we love in Europe and the West is non-existent. And I find it a very, very scary thought that America has done secret deals with such a power behind the scenes, and now it's all being covered up and they don't talk about it. you know, I would say we really, really need to bring this out into the open if it's true. So that's one suspect, right? And there were also parts of the commission report that were about Saudi Arabia that have only just been released as well. So fingers are pointing in that direction. There's another possibility, which is very interesting, and I don't know, I think I'm one of the few 9/11 researchers to ever mention this, but I'm looking at it in my book. And this is the possible involvement of China in the events of 9/11. China is a superpower, certainly has the funds, the money, the contacts to have helped wire the buildings. It's undoubted. Why do I allege there's any possible evidence? Okay. This is a fact that's not known to many people, but when bin Laden was living in Afghanistan, when he went and took shelter with the Taliban, he was a front man for the Taliban government who was sent to Beijing on at least three occasions, and he was there to buy weapons for the Taliban government from China. Tens of millions of dollars worth of sophisticated weaponry was purchased from the Chinese government, who were basically making a military alliance with the Taliban. When the Tora Bora caves were opened and the American forces went in looking for Osama bin Laden, they didn't find him, but they found an awful lot of Chinese weapons. Again, that's not been publicized. I don't know why. These are facts that should be debated, you know, live a lot. The other thing is that Chinese intelligence was in very, very close cahoots with Pakistani intelligence, the ISI. China and Pakistan are very close, because they've been liaising over nuclear know-how, and Pakistan and China have been playing games with India up in the high Himalayas. And China, you know, is flexing its muscles, and using Pakistan as an ally. Now, it's very odd that Osama bin Laden finally turns up, lo and behold, in Pakistan. Well, where's he been all this time? Who's been sheltering him? This is a hypothesis worth exploring, which is that actually China all along knew what bin Laden was up to and actually probably helped fund it. You know, it's possible. And it would explain also why this has never come out in public, because what America, I think America's afraid of China. And, you know, however, I take the view that if this is true, if China was actually behind this, the public have a right to know. And, you know, we should maybe rethink the selling off of Britain's assets to China. You know, we seem to be selling them just about everything. If they were actually responsible for 9/11, I think it has huge security implications.
There is a thing, Thomas, about China. Okay. I'm not sure if you know about this, but here's the thing. In the 1930s and 40s, America put out this thing, says, or the Federal Reserve Group put out and said, we'll look after your gold during these troubled times. And so they took out a whole load of gold and they printed a whole bunch of certificates for the gold. These certificates had slight errors in them that would make them able to be in the future said to be counterfeit. But then, anyway, so there are a whole load of these bonds that went everywhere.
I mean, that was deliberately dishonest. That's, yeah, that's unlike
number
America.
One. Yeah, that's, who'd have thought? Who'd do that? Yeah. So, and so they took the gold and they gave these bonds and certificates in, you know, lovely cases and all looking really cool and brass and nice and anyhow. And so all over the Far East, there are these boxes with these bonds in them. And so, during the 1980s and 90s, China said, we'd like our gold back now, and here's the bonds. And America stoutly, or the Federal Reserve stoutly refused to cash the bonds. And they took them, and China took them to the court of human, you know, the international court thing in The Hague. And The Hague said, yeah, you gotta pay, guys. And, they eventually, you know, bowed their heads and said, okay, so when do you want it? And they said, well, you can deliver the gold on September the 12th, 2001.
Okay, that's interesting timing, isn't it?
Isn't it? And yeah. The gold was underneath Building 7.
Okay, I've heard of these stories. And was it was found, wasn't it, and shipped out?
Yeah. So it's a double heist that they said they were going to give it back to the Chinese. Now they can say, oh, it's under the buildings. They were destroyed. We can't get the gold. Sorry.
How much gold was there? An awful lot.
Oh, yeah. Imagine, it's the biggest, how much does America owe China? That's how much. Right.
And oh my God. So, well, that sheds an interesting light on the
exactly.
China collection.
So and I have another faction for you. And, I don't know if you're aware of Project Paperclip.
Of course, yeah.
It never stopped.
Well.
And it's today known it's today known as the rendering system. You know, where they render prisoners?
I met a guy wandering around the streets of Athens who told me in absolute earnestness that the Nazis won World War II, but this had all been covered up.
Well,
I had a dispute. I said, no, surely if that were true, someone would have told the Queen.
Maybe the Queen knew all along. Maybe the bombing of Dresden was to disguise the fact that the Queen used to be there and what they used to get up to.
Can I just say,
let's keep focused. Let's keep focused on 9/11.
I don't want to go down the Nazis did 9/11 route because Bush was the grandson of Hitler and all that. There is a kind of faction out there that would say that. I want to stick with more mainstream historical analysis for now, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Those things which have a life of their own, they're interesting, but I don't want to go down there.
Yeah, so,
I want to look
but anyway, the Chinese thing is definitely out there. You can check it out. It really happened, and it's a factor. I'm just trying to add to this
thank
pie.
Okay, so we've got two possible candidates. We've got Saudi Arabia, we've got China. I want to throw in Israel into the mix, because there are many 9/11 researchers that say that Mossad was involved, and they point to lots of possible weird stuff that seem to indicate, jubilant Mossad agents filming the events, strange Mossad art students all happening to be hanging out close to Al-Qaeda agents. A lot of the key actors in the Bush administration and in the running of the World Trade Center itself, and who benefited from these events. Some of them even had dual American-Israeli nationality, so they had like a split loyalty. And there is, I know Israel very well. I have many wonderful Israeli friends, and I stay when I'm in Israel close to Mossad headquarters, actually. And once I thought I ought to just knock on the door and go and ask them what they know. Not sure I would have got out, but I would really love to interview them, because I find it difficult to believe that they would have wired the buildings. I just can't believe they're that stupid. America is the fund support for Israel's continuing existence in the Middle East. They depend on her. I cannot believe that Israeli agents cooked up such a ridiculous project. There is a the logic runs something like this. We, Mossad, we care about Israel's security. That's our mission statement. We hate Saddam Hussein, who's very anti-Semitic. If we help 9/11, because we know that Al-Qaeda are planning to blow, hit planes in. They were tracking bin Laden, by the way. It was their sources that knew he was going to China. So they might say to themselves, well, we know it's happening. Nobody will mind if we just, help the buildings come down. It'll look bigger. And then we can help, dominate the media so that the anger is all turned against Iraq, and it'll help Israel's long-term security policy in the Middle East. Is it possible some people thought that? I mean, as I say, the Israelis I know are all highly intelligent, and I can't believe they would have fallen for that stupid nonsense. But I'm not saying there might not be some hardcore kind of fanatical Zionist elements that hated Iraq so much that they might have even cooked up such a scheme and talked some American operatives into supporting it. I suspend judgment. I hope it's not true. but I think one has to look where the evidence leads. Another possibility is that, no, it was Saudi Arabia, but they made it look as if it was Israel. Because very early on, Saudi Arabia was saying it was Mossad that did 9/11. And of course that ratchets up anti-Semitism all around the world. You know, the kind of crazy people that stab people in the street in London or Paris are fed anti-Semitic nonsense, and they think they're fighting the good fight against the devil's children. There's a very important book called A Genealogy of Evil by David Paterson, Anti-Semitism from Nazism to Islamic Jihad, that explores how, after the end of World War II, a lot of the top Nazi ideologues actually went to Syria and the Middle East and Egypt and were, you know, marrying up their ideology with forms of pseudo-Islam. And actually it's this that underlay Al-Qaeda and bin Laden's way of thinking. And the propaganda that comes out in Saudi Arabia that all Jews are pigs. And
yeah, the Islamic Brotherhood kind of thing.
Well, that's it. The Muslim Brotherhood
is
the vehicle for this anti-Jewish stuff. Now, I'm opposed to all that, you see. If we go back and say we need to reprogram the hatred back to love, which is where I'm coming from, then we need to somehow heal these ancient splits. So whoever did 9/11, whether it was Saudi Arabia, China, Israel, USA, CIA, you know, Pakistan, whatever, I'm saying that we need to come clean about it. We need to draw a slate under it and begin again, you know, as mankind. Stop the wars that have come from it. And this is why I set up the Truth and Reconciliation Commission for the Middle East. I would plead with anyone listening to this program that has information to get in touch with me. You know, you'll find my website, just Google it. And I think that only through truth, are we going to get release from this pain. And the alternative to peace and reconciliation would seem to be just continual wars and continual, let's call them revenge holocausts. You know, you try and exterminate my people, I'll try and exterminate yours. I think that's not intelligent. As a philosopher of peace, I'd say that's a very stupid thing for mankind to be playing at.
Well, this is what happens to people who have PTSD. They've lost the higher consciousness of knowing the history, and they're just day by day in the war. How do you? Yes.
What's your therapy project? If it's
all right, so
intergalactic wars.
Okay, so because you know you're describing in you could say in the cosmic short term, i.e., the last 2,000-3,000 years of conflict in the Middle East, you know. What you're describing is like a small version of what has been going on in these galactic wars, which I was talking about on that call. And we're here in a small theater. And the idea is that we work it out because this is a sandbox. How do we play this out to the end? And how do we resolve it and reintegrate the family? It's like, it's just brothers against brothers in the end.
Can I bring in something else here, which is something I've been working on in the castle in Scotland where I live?
In the castle, please. Yeah. As you shiver there with a fireplace 200 feet away from the nearest wall.
Yeah. So anyway, I worked on many things to do with esoteric history and philosophy, but the most interesting is I did a commentary on the three books of Enoch. Now, Enoch is a very interesting prophet, and he has three books ascribed to his name. He's revered in the Islamic tradition as Idris. He's sacred to the Jewish people, and particularly at Qumran, and you've seen scraps of papyrus that they found. There were writings, you know, the books of Enoch were studied in the Essene community. We also know the book of Enoch was studied by early Christians because it's quoted in the letter of James. And Jesus is obviously working in an Enochian tradition because the kingdom of God, which is his big idea, and his angelic conversations, he's always talking to angels, those are hallmarks of the Enochian brand of esotericism that was around. So I thought, this is very interesting, let's study these books of Enoch. Nobody knows about them. They're actually in the Ethiopian Bible, which I think is really cool. The Ethiopians have kept them in there. The Western Catholic and Protestants kicked them out.
So the Ethiopians have pristine copies of it, yeah?
Yeah, and a copy was brought back by James Bruce, a Freemason from Scotland in the 1700s. He went all the way to Ethiopia and brought back the Book of Enoch, which I did a commentary on using the University of Glasgow Theology Department, which is brilliant, by the way. So what does it say? Well, this is the interesting bit. What it says is, it's the backstory to the Garden of Eden and the snake and the banishment. What it says is that this planet was bubbling along happily, populated by fairly benign hominids who walked around partly on knuckles and, you know, were quite sweet. They were. And then these fallen angels appeared, led by someone called Shemjazzer, who were a troop of devilish angels. And they brought knowledge of weaponry to mankind. And their top angels fell in love with these hominid women. They lusted after them and created a kind of strange hybrid species of giants, Nephilim. And things have been going bad and downhill ever since. That's why the flood happened. Now, in Enoch, who was the grandfather of Noah, he knew all this. This was the stories that he was told as a child. What Enoch learned to do was to navigate between the worlds. He was the first shamanic voyager into the afterlife. And he went to the heaven worlds on a Merkava, which is a chariot, right? He talks to the angels who take him up through the seven spheres of heaven. And at one point they show him hell, burning lakes of fire, in which these original naughty angels have been trapped and are being punished by God. They plead with Enoch to put in a good word and saying they didn't mean it. Sorry, it was the women's fault, etc. And then Enoch goes up to heaven and talks to God. And he has these incredible adventures. So what in my commentary I've explored is that in these texts, which were suppressed really by mainstream Orthodox Christianity, and in Islam, they're not really studied. It's a problem with Islamic education. They don't study the Kabbalah. They don't study sacred Jewish and Christian scriptures. Muhammad didn't know about the New Testament. He'd never read a gospel. So one of my strategies to solve these problems is education, getting people from different faiths to study each other's sacred scriptures. But I'm just sharing with you that it might be this intergalactic narrative of demonic intelligences might have been in the Book of Enoch all along, which would be interesting. But the solution to it is also there. Because, and this, I think, if you reinterpret the Islamic, Jewish, Christian faith parts as a response, what to do with this primal narrative, you call it the traumatic shock of the fallen angels and their impact on us. If it's all in Enoch, then I think the antidote is also there, which is wisdom. As Christ said, perceiving the kingdom of God, seeing the inner secrets. There's one passage in the gospel, in the books of Enoch, which is amazing. Enoch eventually ends up in heaven working as chief scribe to God, right? He's up in the throne room and he's given access to all the archives and records. As a scholar and historian, you know, I can't wait to see the heavenly library. Okay? And Enoch, I'm sure, is like the head librarian. But he's shown this thing in front of God. There's a kind of shimmering screen, which is described. And on that are shimmering patterns of light and numbers, which represent every single human life that's ever had incarnation and all their karmic deeds and mistakes and good things. And so to me, it sounds like a kind of computer screen almost. It's like a curtain with these shimmering images playing on them. And Enoch is shown that by God and is asked to kind of help with the judgment, because what happens in that throne room is it's a place of morality. So whoever did 9/11, whoever's done, you know, whoever killed Kennedy, whoever killed Princess Diana and so on, they're on that screen. And ultimately, you know, they're found out. They have to apologize. What I'm saying is, let's fast forward. Don't wait till you're dead. You know, if you know stuff, you were involved in wrongdoing, come forward now. Clear your slate. That's the point of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission for the Middle East. And, you know, when you finally get to that throne room, the Scream is going to look a bit better for you. Anyway, that's that, that. I thought some of your listeners might... Have you ever read the books of Enoch yourself?
I would be fascinated to read them. I started off reading Gilgamesh, and then it got all bitty and didn't make sense. So I couldn't, I only read two chapters that were full, and they made sense. But I would, you know, sometimes, hey, Thomas, would you like to do a reading of these books of Enoch? Would you like a regular time when you come and you read those books and maybe discuss them?
What, on your radio show?
On, you know, to have a show, to have your own show.
Well, I have actually recorded the books of Enoch and the commentaries on them. I'm happy to share bits of them.
Could I play parts of them and you could discuss them? You know, we could do,
sure.
We could do that.
The easiest way is I send you the discs that they're on. You play a regular slot, half an hour or whatever. And then we could have a little discussion at the end of it.
Yeah.
Because I think they're really important. And if you see, if all the Muslims, Jews, and Christians of the world listen to my commentaries on the books of Enoch, I'm not joking. I don't want to exaggerate here, but I honestly think they would stop killing each other and start loving each other. You know, because the books are so interesting that and they put everything in a cosmological perspective, which means that we should collaborate. You see, I just want to end with saying one thing that. If the cosmological explanation is partly true, the books of Enoch, you know, there's a kind of been a fall of negative energies onto the planet somehow, and they're not all completely sorted yet, then the worst thing we can do as humans is go on having wars amongst each other. Because whatever demonic intelligences want humanity to fail, their main strategy is to foment discord between the religions and the nations and the cultures of the planet. And we've got to see through that game. We've got to unite the saints and sages of the planet from all religions, and get on the same team, so to speak, so that we're, you used the word anti-humanist earlier. We have to become proper humanists to support life-giving, life-affirming, love-creating projects in every nation. And by using that secret weapon which we have, or secret tool, which is love, and I publish, by the way, the only academic journal in the world on the nature of love. Incredibly, no other academics have ever thought of researching love properly. You know, it's absurd, isn't it? By activating that positive consciousness that you talked about earlier, then I think we can see off the divisive energies that may be trying to, I don't know, colonize this planet or turn humans into kind of robot slaves so they can harvest us. I don't know what nonsense is going on. But what I would say to them is they've got to leave this planet. Enoch and the team are onto them. And, you know, there should be no room for these idiot energies to continue sowing discord among human beings. If we listen to the sages and saints of each of our cultures, if we study their wisdom, elders, you know, we can make peace like tomorrow. So I remain an optimist. I'm not a pessimist. You know, we are going to win this, and we're going to do it with love and non-violence and with wisdom, which is the eternal, you know, law in action. Yes. So, oh, and I should just say, by the way, on that, I've been to India 8 times and I've met spiritual leaders all over the planet. I've been all around the States and every country around Europe. I've traveled in 35 countries meeting spiritual elders. And eventually I thought, let's get them to sign an interfaith peace treaty. Because how do wars end? In your opinion, how do wars end?
Well, either both sides have suffered too many losses, or one side suffers too many losses, or somebody sees the light and stops fighting, and then the other person says, why have you stopped fighting? And then the other person says, because I've seen the light. Why can't you see it? And the other person says, oh, I see the light now. And then everybody stops fighting. That would be nice.
Okay, but normally the formal thing is that the leaders of both sides sit down and sign a peace treaty, like happened, you know, in Versailles, or at the end of the first really important peace treaty in European history was the Treaty of Westphalia, which ended the 30 Years' War in Germany and the continent. And at the end of World War I, there was a peace treaty and so on. So it's a peace treaty that signs. So I've come up with an interfaith peace treaty whereby the, you know, the great powers of religions can sign a pledge that their followers will not attack and kill each other. It's got its own website.
So all you have to do is convince the imams and the popes and everything will be good.
That project is well in hand, my dear friend.
Good, good, good. So listen, we're completely out of time. Thomas, it's been a real, you know, broadening of the horizon. I like to bring people in with various diverse points of view, because it's, for me, it's the way to peace is through perspective and the recognition of perspective, is that everybody's got their perspective and it's fine. And you don't have to hurt anybody because their perspective is different as to how the world was created and who did it, you know, and all that stuff, you know, what story is about. So
sure, it's just storytellers.
It's just storytellers. And that's where we began. Thomas, you were always a great storyteller. Tonight we've had some great stories. Please, now, in the next couple of minutes, or in actually in about the next 30 seconds, could you rattle off your websites? How can people get in touch with you? How can they help you with your projects? Is there a kind of central hub website? Go ahead.
Okay, so the most important one is www.educationaid.net. That's like Live Aid, but for the educational community. So educationaid.net. Okay. From there, you'll find links to all the other websites and other projects. I've also got active Facebook pages. Just search under my name. The Interfaith Peace Treaty, again, has its own website. Just Google interfaithpeacetreaty.wordpress.com and it comes up. And if you're interested in contributing in some small way to the ongoing work, you can add your name to that. You know, Jeremy, I invite you to read it and put your name forward, sign it. And I think you'll find things in that Interfaith Peace Treaty that are seriously interesting. Get the people at FinTorn to sign it, you know, your friends, whatever faith.
Me, get. You can't, look, I don't get anybody to do anything. All I can leave
encourage.
Them.
Encourage.
Yeah, encourage, bully. Bully with a stick. How about that? Shall I do that? I can be coercive for peace.
Probably not. No, the Druid Peace Order, we don't use violence or wands and staffs.
Yeah, know? But not held up above people's heads saying, I'll hit you with this staff if you don't vote for me.
Certainly not. And can I just finish with Aristotle's phrase? This everything we've said today, you know, and discussed, it's ongoing research and I'm still working on all this. I hope to publish this book maybe in the next year. I've published so far about 40 books of different aspects of history and philosophy. The research I'm doing on 9/11, again, if anyone has data out there that they think is relevant, from whatever country they come in the world, wherever they're coming at this from, please send it to me. Send me an email. I will look at the evidence. I'll weave it into the narrative if it seems appropriate. But I love Aristotle's phrase. It is the mark of an educated mind to be able to entertain a thought without accepting it.
Absolutely.
In other words, you know, I'm a great lover of Aristotle, who was the teacher of Alexander the Great. To think properly, to think through 9/11, we have to look at all the hypotheses. Was it China? Was it Saudi Arabia? Was it Israel? Was it et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And then weigh them, you know? And eventually, I hope that my children will have finally found out the truth about all these things. And that we can turn the narrative back to a narrative of love instead of fear and hatred.
Well, we're starting here.
My final gift is the word terrorism has become very commonplace. Everyone's afraid of terror. You used it. And you rightly said we're all afraid of fear. I've coined a word called joyism.
Yes, I've been waiting for this. The opposite of terrorism. Well done.
Yeah, but the opposite of terrorism. So joyism is the antidote, if you want. And as we cultivate joy in our own personal lives, friendships, you know, being in nature, being with the trees, whatever, reading, spending a day in a library, you know, these things bring joy. Together we can you know, countermand the energy of fear and terror. So with that thought, I will sign off and go back to the fields of France.
Thank you very much, Thomas, and we'll try and get a pair of headphones out to you.
thank you, brilliant, yeah, okay.
Bless your heart. Thank you so much. This has been Ever Beyond with Thomas Dufferne. Thank you so much. Stand by for Frank Jordan and the World Healers.